The Duke of Blackwood, Alistair St. John, considered his wife. He did so in the same manner he might consider a newly acquired porcelain vase, with a detached assessment of its placement within the grander scheme of his drawing room. She was, at that moment, standing near the French doors, a slip of a woman in a gown, the color of faded lilacs, and she was fundamentally failing at her one required task, to be decorative. She was not blending in, nor was she standing out. She was simply present, a quiet disruption. Her presence was a question mark in a room full of declarative statements. He had acquired her, along with 10,000 acres of arable land and a crumbling barony, 3 months prior. The arrangement had been a masterpiece of unsentimental logic. Her father, the Baron Croft, had been a man of poor habits and even poorer accounting, leaving his estate teetering on the precipice of a disgraceful ruin that would have sent ripples through their rarefied society. Alistair, whose own estates bordered Croft's, had offered a solution that was both elegant and final. He would absorb the debt, the land, and the title. And the daughter, Miss Eleanor Vance, had been the final, solvent asset. Her dowry was the land itself. The marriage was a seal upon a deed, a transaction that tidied up a messy affair with the clean lines of a legal contract. He had reviewed the terms with his solicitor, Mr. Davies, with the same cool focus he applied to the acquisition of a new colt for his stables. It was a sound investment. He had expected a biddable, grateful creature, overwhelmed by the sudden elevation to the station of Duchess. He had expected her to be a quiet fixture, a placeholder at his table who would eventually produce an heir and otherwise remain unobtrusive. He had not expected her to be invisible. It was a peculiar sort of invisibility. She was physically there, of course. Her posture was perfect, her movements economical. But she possessed an unnerving stillness, a self-contained quality that seemed to repel attention. People's eyes slid past her. Conversations flowed around her as if she were a stone in a stream. He watched as Lord Harrington, a man whose boisterous vacuity Alistair tolerated for reasons of long acquaintance, approached her. Harrington bowed, his gesture florid and faintly mocking. Alistair could not hear his words, but he saw the predatory gleam in the man's eyes. He saw his wife, the Duchess of Blackwood, incline her head. She offered a single, quiet response. Harrington's smile faltered. He said something else, more insistent this time. She met his gaze, and her expression did not change, yet something in it made Harrington recoil as if he had touched a live coal. He offered a clumsy, hasty retreat, his face a mask of confusion. Alistair frowned. He had not seen her do anything. She had simply been. The incident was forgotten as the evening wore on. A swirl of polite conversation and clinking crystal. Alistair was a consummate host. He managed his guests with the same effortless authority he managed his holdings. He was powerful, respected, and profoundly bored. His life was a series of obligations met, duties discharged, and expectations fulfilled. His marriage was merely the latest. Later that week, he was in his library, a room he cherished. It was a masculine space of dark wood and worn leather, but it had fallen into a state of benign neglect. Books were piled in precarious stacks, ledgers were left open, and a fine layer of dust coated the surfaces. His housekeepers were too intimidated to touch. He was wrestling with a particularly thorny issue regarding tenant disputes on the newly acquired Croft lands. The former Baron's steward was an idiot, and the rent rolls were a work of fiction. He had muttered his frustration aloud to the empty room. The man cannot distinguish between a tenant and a turnip. The entire western parcel is a logistical quagmire. He had left for his clubs, spent the afternoon in a haze of cigar smoke and political debate, and returned late. The next morning, upon entering the library, he found a single sheet of foolscap placed squarely in the center of his blotter. On it, in a neat, precise hand, was a list. It detailed a simple three-step solution to the quagmire on the western parcel. It involved cross-referencing the parish tithe records with the old steward's daybooks, a method so brutally efficient and obvious that he was furious he had not thought of it himself. There was no signature. There was no need for one. He knew the hand. It was the same script that appeared on the household menus she approved each morning, the same measured penmanship on the notes she left for the housekeeper. He felt a flicker of surprise, quickly suppressed. A fluke. A moment of accidental brilliance from a woman with too much time on her hands. He pocketed the note and gave the orders. The solution, of course, worked perfectly. He did not mention it to her. To acknowledge it would be to acknowledge that he had noticed her, and the terms of their silent contract were that he was not required to. She was a presence in his house, a name attached to his title. She was the Duchess. She was not Eleanor. This state of affairs continued. She was a ghost at his table, a shadow in his halls. She was present and she was absent. She was there and she was not there. She managed his household with a silent, unnerving competence. Expenses dropped. The staff, who had been terrified of his exacting standards, seemed to settle into a new rhythm, one of quiet efficiency. The quality of the meals improved. The long neglected gardens began to show signs of thoughtful intervention, with dead roses pruned and new beds prepared for planting. He noticed these things in the periphery, the way one notices a change in the light. He did not connect them to the quiet woman in the lilac gray gowns. He saw the effects, but he refused to see the cause. She was a component of the estate, and the estate was running well. That was all. The breaking point came on a Tuesday, a day of relentless, drizzling rain. Alistair had invited a few of his closest circle for cards and brandy in his study, a smaller, more private room than the grand library. Harrington was there, of course, along with two other lords of similar vintage, men for whom wit was a blunt instrument and conversation a competitive sport. Alistair was on his third brandy. The warmth of it had loosened the tight coil of control he usually maintained. They were laughing about some political folly when the door opened. Eleanor stood on the threshold. She was holding a leather-bound portfolio. He recognized it as containing the final surveyor's reports from the Croft estate, which he had been waiting for. She had evidently just received them from the courier. Her eyes scanned the room, taking in the men, the haze of smoke, the decanters on the table. She looked, as always, unnervingly calm. She took a step inside, her intention clearly to place the portfolio on his desk. Before she could move further, Harrington, his face flushed with drink, called out with a lazy drawl, "Well, well, Blackwood, you keep your little mouse hidden away. Is she allowed out of her cage?" The other men chuckled. It was the casual cruelty of their class, a sport he had engaged in himself a thousand times. A prickle of irritation went through Alistair. Not because of the insult to his wife, he had barely registered her as such, but because it was an intrusion. This was his space, his sanctuary from the duties of the main house. He turned his head slowly, his gaze falling upon her. He did not see a woman. He saw an interruption. He saw a clerk, a servant, a disruption to his leisure. The brandy spoke for him, its voice cold and sharp. "This is a private gathering," he said, his tone clipped and dismissive. "You were not invited here." The words hung in the air, brutal and absolute. The laughter in the room died. Even Harrington had the grace to look momentarily uncomfortable. Eleanor stopped. She stood perfectly still for one, two, three heartbeats. Her face was a blank canvas. He had expected a flicker of hurt, a blush of shame, perhaps even tears. There was nothing. She simply looked at him, her gaze clear and analytical, as if she were committing a specimen to memory. Then she turned. She did not hurry. She placed the leather portfolio on a console table just outside the study door, its placement precise. She closed the study door with a soft, final click. Alistair felt a surge of satisfaction. The intrusion had been dealt with. The order of his world had been restored. He poured another brandy. "Well handled, Duke," one of the lords murmured, breaking the silence. "Can't have the ladies interfering with important business." The card game resumed, but for Alistair, the taste of the brandy had turned to ash. He found he could not focus on the cards. The image of her face, that blank, assessing look, was imprinted on his mind. He had dismissed her. He had dismissed the Duchess of Blackwood from his presence as one would a footman, and she had simply complied. That night, he slept in his own vast empty bed and thought nothing of it. He had always slept alone. The next morning, he passed her in the hall. He inclined his head in a curt nod. She was supposed to curtsy, or at least acknowledge him. She did not. She looked straight through him, her focus on the far end of the corridor, and continued walking. It was not a snub. It was worse. It was a complete and total erasure of his existence. He was a piece of furniture she had no need to navigate around. He felt an unfamiliar sting. It was annoyance, he told himself. A breach of protocol. He did not know then, but he would later pinpoint this as the moment the door truly closed. It was not the click of the study door he had heard the day before. It was the sound of something far more significant. Shutting, a quiet internal mechanism turning a lock for which he did not possess the key. 2 days later, she found the letter. It was an accident. She had been in the library, not to tidy it for him, but to find a specific book on botany she had requested from a London bookseller. The housekeeper, flustered by a delivery, had mistakenly placed a small locked document box of the Duke's on a shelf among the gardening folios. Eleanor, seeing it was out of place, intended to move it to his study. The lock was old and poorly made. As she lifted the box, the clasp gave way, and the contents spilled across the floor. They were old papers, mostly receipts and minor correspondence, and one folded, creased letter. It was a draft, written in Alistair's own hand, full of crossouts and amendments. It was addressed to his solicitor, Mr. Davies, and dated 4 months prior. She should not have read it. It was a violation of his privacy. But her own name, Miss Vance, caught her eye. She picked it up. Her hands did not tremble. Her breathing did not hitch. She read the letter with the same calm, analytical focus she had given Lord Harrington, the same gaze she had turned on her husband in the study. "Davies," it began. "Proceed with the Croft arrangement. The terms are acceptable. Settle the debts. Absorb the lands. As for the daughter, she will suffice. I have seen her. She is plain, silent, and appears blessedly free of a personality. She will not be a complication. Consider her the final, necessary asset to close the deal. See to it. The final, necessary asset." She folded the letter carefully along its original creases. She put it back in the box with the other papers, closed the lid, and carried the box to his study. She placed it on the center of his desk, where he could not miss it. Her reaction was not one of rage. It was not one of heartbreak. Heartbreak required a heart that had been offered and rejected, and hers had never been part of the transaction. Her reaction was one of profound, clarifying coldness. It was the quiet click of a tumbler falling into place. She had understood the nature of their marriage. She was not a fool. It was a merger, a convenience. But she had, perhaps, held on to a shred of hope that she might, in time, become a person to him, a partner, if not in affection, then at least in duty. The letter, coupled with the public humiliation of his dismissal, erased that shred. Asset, complication, plain, silent. He had not seen a woman. He had seen an inventory item. And his dismissal was not a moment of drunken carelessness. It was the purest expression of his opinion of her. She was not part of his life. She was an object in his house. "You were not invited here." He had meant it, and so she made a decision. It was a quiet decision, made in the silence of her own mind. If she was not invited, she would not stay. An asset could be moved. A complication could be removed. She began to prepare. Her actions were methodical, precise, and completely invisible to the man whose house she shared. She did not pack trunks. She did not alert her maid. She simply began to withdraw, not just from him, but from the house itself. Alistair first noticed her absence at dinner. He had not, he realized with a jolt, seen her in 3 days. Not in the halls, not in the gardens, not a whisper of her presence. The dining table was a vast, polished expanse of mahogany between his seat at the head and her empty chair at the foot. The silence was different. Before, it had been a contained silence, the quietude of her presence. Now, it was a hollow silence, an emptiness that echoed. "Where is the Duchess?" he asked the footman who was serving him. The man started, surprised to be addressed directly. "Her Grace has been taking her meals in her rooms. Your Grace.
Is she unwell?"
"She has not said Your Grace." He frowned. This was a deviation from the routine. It was inefficient. It created more work for the staff. He was annoyed. The next day, he entered the library and found it exactly as he had left it. A chaotic mess. For weeks, it had been subtly ordering itself around him. Books he had been searching for would appear on his desk. Relevant research materials would be laid out. Now, that quiet, helpful intelligence was gone. The room was once again just a room, full of his own disorganization. Then he noticed the music had stopped, or rather, he noticed the absence of it. Every evening, from the music room, the faint, melancholic notes of a Chopin nocturne or a Bach prelude would drift through the house. He had never paid it any mind, assuming it was one of the maids practicing. Now, the evenings were utterly still. He asked the housekeeper, Mrs. Gable, a woman who had been with his family for 40 years and feared nothing, not even him. Mrs. Gable, who is it that plays the pianoforte in the evenings? Abe. She looked at him, her expression unreadable. It was the Duchess, Your Grace, was. Past tense. Alistair felt that strange prickling sensation again. It was as if his house, his perfectly run, perfectly ordered world, was slowly having its soul removed, piece by piece, and he was only just noticing the empty spaces left behind. He was noticing the absence of a thing he had never properly acknowledged the presence of. An untouched meal, an empty chair, a silent pianoforte, an unorganized library. The flowers in the main hall began to wilt. He started to look for her, not to speak to her, but to observe. To confirm she was still there, he would catch a glimpse of her, a flash of a gray dress, disappearing down a corridor, a silhouette in a window of the east wing. She was there, but she was not. She moved through his house like a phantom, leaving no trace, making no sound. The accumulation of these small clues began to form a pattern in his mind. He thought about the note with the solution to the tenant problem. He thought about the effortless way his household had been running. He thought about the sudden retreat of Lord Harrington, baffled by her quiet refusal. He thought about the music. He had assumed she was simple. He had mistaken silence for emptiness. The catalyst arrived a week after his dismissal of her, in the form of his solicitor. Mr. Davies was a tall, desiccated man, who seemed to have been born in a dusty legal tome. He never wasted words. Your Grace, Davies said, taking a seat in the now chaotic library. We have a problem. Alistair arched an eyebrow. I have many problems, Davies. You will have to be more specific. A problem regarding your marriage contract. Alistair's attention sharpened. What of it? It is ironclad. Indeed, Davies said, his voice dry as parchment. Particularly Clause 11, Subsection B, the clause of mutual respect and habitation. Alistair had no memory of such a clause. He remembered the financial details, the transfer of lands, the settlement of debts. The rest was boilerplate. And it is a somewhat archaic clause, Davies continued, looking at a document in his hands, but legally binding. It stipulates that for the contract to remain in full force, both parties must maintain a shared and respectful cohabitation. It was designed to prevent a husband from simply marrying a woman for her fortune and then casting her aside to live in some forgotten corner of the estate while he carried on as a bachelor. I have not cast her aside, Alistair said, a defensive edge to his voice. She resides here.
Does she?
Davies asked, his gaze pointed. I have received a letter. From the Duchess's solicitor, they contend that you have, and I quote, created an environment wherein respectful cohabitation is rendered impossible, thereby nullifying the spirit and letter of the agreement. They cite a specific incident, and Alistair felt a cold dread begin to pool in his stomach. "The study, indeed. You were not invited here," Davies quoted softly. "A public declaration," they argue, "that the shared habitation is no longer in effect from your side. It is a clever, if aggressive, interpretation." "One, she cannot be serious," Alistair scoffed. "It was a trifle, a careless word." "The Duchess, Mr.," Davies said, a faint, almost imperceptible hint of admiration in his tone, "does not strike me as a woman who deals in trifles. I noted it when we prepared the documents. She read every line, twice. She asked me a very specific question about the wording of that particular clause. I confess, at the time, I thought it was merely academic curiosity." The solicitor's words struck Alistair with physical force. She had known. From the very beginning, she had seen the loophole, the one small escape hatch in the ironclad contract he had used to purchase her. "What does she want?" Alistair asked, his voice low. "For now, nothing. The letter is merely a notification of her position. It states that as the contract has been breached by you, she no longer considers herself bound by its terms. She is, in her view, no longer your wife." "My." The room was silent save for the ticking of the mantel clock. No longer his wife. The words were absurd. He had a title, a special license, a contract. But the contract, he was beginning to realize, was not the paper it was written on. It was the person who had signed it. After Davies left, Alistair sat in his library for a long time. He felt a profound sense of dislocation. His world, which had always operated on clear, logical rules, had just been upended by a quiet woman and an archaic clause in a contract he had not bothered to read properly. He stood up and walked through the silent house, his footsteps echoing. He went to her wing. He stopped before the doors to her suite and, for the first time, hesitated. He knocked. There was no answer. He turned the handle. The door was unlocked. He pushed it open. The rooms were immaculate and empty. Her bed was made. The wardrobe was closed, but the small, personal items that had marked her presence were gone. The book of poetry from the side table, the silver-backed brush from the vanity. The small watercolor set he had vaguely noticed on a writing desk. It was not the room of a woman who was taking her meals there. It was the room of a woman who had left. His eyes scanned the space, searching for, he did not know what. A note, an explanation. His gaze fell on his own desk, which he had ordered moved into the adjoining sitting room of the suite weeks ago, a convenience for when he worked late. And on it, placed dead center, was the small, locked document box from the library. He walked over to it. The lid was closed. He lifted it. He saw the spill of papers and on top, the creased folded draft of his letter to Davies, the final, necessary asset. He picked it up. He read the words he had written in a moment of cold, transactional arrogance. He saw them now not as a private thought, but through her eyes. He connected the cold dismissal in the letter with the cold dismissal in his study. Asset. Complication. You were not invited here. It was an epiphany. A brutal, clarifying light that burned away all his assumptions. He had not just insulted her. He had confirmed her deepest fear, the very truth of her situation. He had shown her, in his own handwriting, that she was nothing more to him than a piece of property. He sank into the chair, the letter still in his hand. He thought about the quiet competence. He thought about the intelligent solution to the estate problem. He thought about the music that filled the halls, music he had never once acknowledged. He thought about her stillness, not as emptiness, but as a deep, guarded well of self-possession. He had been given a treasure, and he had locked it in a storeroom and never bothered to look at it. He was not a fool. He was a blind man. A man who had looked at a diamond and seen only a stone. And now, she was gone. Her departure was not an act of feminine pique. It was not a tantrum. It was the logical, final move in a game he had not even known he was playing. She had not run away. She had resigned. She had assessed the terms of her position, found them unacceptable, and terminated her own contract. Section, section, and in a stroke of genius that left him breathless, she had taken the evidence with her. He remembered the leather portfolio she had carried to his study, the surveyor's reports. He had assumed that was all. He looked at the console table by the door. It was empty. Mrs. Gable later confirmed it. The Duchess had left the house carrying a single leather portfolio. Inside, he now knew, was not just the report, but also the original, signed marriage contract, the very document her solicitor now cited. She had taken the chain itself. Alistair Straint, John, the Duke of Blackwood, a man who had never been wrong-footed in his life, put his head in his hands. He had made a catastrophic error, and the full, crushing weight of it was only just beginning to settle upon him. He had to find her. It was not difficult. She had not tried to hide. She had simply retreated. He learned from a tight-lipped Mr. Davies that she had taken up residence at a place called Holly Cottage, a small, forgotten dower house on the farthest edge of the Croftlands. Her lands. It was a property so insignificant he had not even noted it on his maps. He rode out himself, alone. It took him half a day. The countryside shifted from the manicured perfection of his own domain to the wilder, slightly unkempt beauty of the former Croft estate. He found the cottage nestled in a small valley, a curl of smoke rising from its chimney. It was modest, stone-built, and surrounded by a garden that was a riot of untamed roses and overgrown herbs. He found her in that garden. She was on her knees, wearing a simple cotton dress with her sleeves rolled up, her hands covered in dirt. She was patiently, methodically, weeding a patch of earth. She looked up as his shadow fell over her. She was not surprised to see him. She was not angry. She was not hurt. She looked at him with that same unnerving, quiet appraisal. She looked content. "Your grace," she said, her voice even. It was a statement, not a question. He dismounted, his fine London boots sinking into the soft soil. He felt absurdly out of place, a creature of drawing rooms and boardrooms transplanted into the real world. He had rehearsed a dozen speeches on the ride over, apologies, explanations, demands. They all evaporated in the face of her calm. He chose the only words that mattered. The truth. "I was wrong," he said. The admission felt like shedding a skin. "I read the letter. The one I wrote to Davies." She said nothing. She simply watched him, her hands resting on the dark earth. "It was an accurate reflection of my thinking at the time," he continued, forcing the words out. "I saw our marriage as a transaction. I saw you as a component of that transaction. I did not see you." He gestured around at the cottage, the garden, at her. "I have spent the last week in a house that has become a hollow shell. I noticed your absence in a thousand small ways. The silence, the lack of order, the lack of life. I was blind, arrogant and blind." He was not asking for forgiveness. He was making a statement of fact, a confession to a judge who had already passed sentence. "I understand why you left," he finished, his voice raw. "And I understand the claim you have made through your solicitor. It is valid." 1. For the first time, a flicker of something moved in her eyes. It might have been surprise. She rose to her feet, wiping her hands on an apron. "The contract was breached," she stated simply. "The terms were not met." "I know." They stood there for a long moment, the silence broken only by the buzzing of bees in the wild roses. He had come here to retrieve his Duchess. He realized now he was here to meet Eleanor Vance for the first time. Before he could say more, she turned toward the cottage. "Would you care for some tea, Your Grace? It is a long ride back to Blackwood Manor." The invitation was a dismissal, a polite, final closing of the door. He had made his confession, and now he was expected to leave. But Alistair did something he had never done. he refused to be dismissed. "No," he said. "Thank you." He did not leave. He simply stood there, a silent sentinel in her garden, watching as she went inside. He remained for an hour, saying nothing, doing nothing, just being present. Finally, as the sun began to dip, he mounted his horse and rode away. He did not go back to London. He returned to Blackwood Manor and did two things. First, he went to his study and wrote a letter to Lord Harrington. It was not a challenge. It was far more lethal. It detailed, with cold precision, his intention to call in every debt Harrington owed to his family's bank, to expose his cheating at cards to the committee at White's, and to purchase the mortgage on his ancestral home. It was a declaration of social and financial annihilation. He signed it, sealed it, and had it sent by special courier. He was burning a bridge to his old world. Second, he summoned Mr. Davies. "I want a new contract," Alistair said. Davies blinked. "A new marriage contract? Your Grace?" "No. A partnership agreement. I want to cede full autonomous control of the Croft lands and all associated incomes to Eleanor." "To the Duchess," he corrected himself. "I want it to be hers, unequivocally, with no claim from me. Ever." The solicitor's eyebrows shot up into his hairline. "Your Grace, that is unprecedented. It would make her one of the wealthiest independent women in England. It would surrender thousands of acres from the ducal estate." "She brought them to this marriage," Alistair said flatly. "They are hers. I am merely correcting a clerical error." It took a week. A week of frantic work from Davies and his clerks. A week during which Alistair received a sputtering, terrified letter from Harrington, followed by news that the man had abruptly departed for the continent. A week during which Alistair lived in the hollow house, overseeing the work, feeling every inch of Eleanor's absence. When the documents were ready, he did not send them. He rode back to Holly Cottage, this time with a heavy satchel of legal papers. He found her again in the garden. She was transplanting seedlings. She did not seem surprised to see him. He did not offer greetings. He unstrapped the satchel and laid the thick sheaf of documents on a weathered stone bench. "This is for you," he said. She looked from his face to the papers, then back again. "What is it?" "It is the deed to your lands, to all of it, free and clear. It is a legal framework that establishes you as their sole owner and administrator. It is yours. There are no conditions." She walked slowly over to the bench and picked up the top document. Her eyes, quick and intelligent, scanned the dense legal text. She was not just reading, she was understanding. He watched her face, searching for a reaction. After several long minutes, she placed the document back on the pile. She looked at him, and her expression was one he had never seen before. It was not cool appraisal. It was confusion. "Why?" she asked, her voice barely a whisper. "Because they were never mine to begin with," he said. "They were part of a transaction I was wrong to make. I am not giving them back to you. I am acknowledging they were always yours." "This does not solve your problem," she said, her mind clearly working through the implications. "You still require an heir." "The dukedom." "The dukedom is my problem," he interrupted gently. "Not yours. You are free, Eleanor. That is all this is." He turned to leave. He had done what he came to do. He had atoned, not with words, but with action. He had dismantled the cage he had built for her and handed her the key. Alistair. It was the first time she had used his given name. He stopped, his back to her. "The tea is still an option," she said softly. He turned around. Her face was still guarded, but the wall of ice was gone. In its place was a fragile, hesitant curiosity. He nodded. "I would like that very much." That was the beginning. It was not a capitulation. It was an opening for negotiation, on entirely new terms. The rebuilding was a slow, quiet affair. He did not move into the cottage. He took rooms at the local inn, a humble establishment that caused the innkeeper to nearly faint. Every day, he would walk the 2 miles to Holly Cottage. He did not come with grand gestures or expensive gifts. He came with his hands empty. He came to listen. He learned her. He learned that her silence was not shyness, but observation. She saw everything, every nuance of conversation, every shift in a person's demeanor. He learned that her love of botany was not a hobby, but a science. She could name every plant, its properties, its history. He learned that her skill with numbers and logic, which he had seen in her solution to the estate problem, was formidable. She could have run a bank. She could have run his entire duchy, and probably done it better than he. He learned the small things. The way a tiny smile touched her lips when she saw a particularly beautiful flower. The way she hummed, slightly off key, when she was concentrating. The dry, sharp wit that would emerge in their conversations. A flash of a rapier that always took him by surprise and left him oddly delighted. One afternoon, he found her struggling to turn over a patch of dense, clay-heavy soil for a new vegetable garden. Without a word, he took off his coat, rolled up his own sleeves, and took the spare spade from the shed. They worked for hours in silence, side by side, the rhythm of their digging a conversation in itself. When they were done, covered in sweat and dirt, she looked at his blistered hands and the ruin of his expensive trousers and laughed, a real, open laugh. The sound struck him as more beautiful than any Chopin nocturne. He began to see her, truly see her, not as a duchess, not as an asset, but as Eleanor. A woman of quiet strength, formidable intelligence, and a deep, resilient spirit. He was not falling in love with an idea of her. He was falling in love with the reality of her, a reality he had been too arrogant to see. He came to understand that her withdrawal had not been an act of weakness, but of immense strength. It was the quiet assertion of her own value. She had refused to be invisible. She had chosen to be absent instead. After a month of this strange, quiet courtship, he came to the cottage one evening as she was closing up the garden for the night. "I have been thinking about contracts," he said, breaking the comfortable silence between them. She looked up, a questioning arch to her brow. "Our first one was flawed," he said. "It was a contract of acquisition. The second one," he gestured vaguely towards the cottage where the deeds now sat, "was a contract of dissolution. I would like to propose a third." He did not kneel. He did not offer a ring. He met her gaze directly, his heart pounding in his chest. "I am asking you to enter into a partnership with me, Eleanor, a partnership of equals. I am asking you to be my wife, not because a contract says you must, but because you choose to. Because I see you, and I value you, and my life is a hollow and meaningless thing without you in it." He took a breath. "I love you, and I would be honored if you would consent to be the Duchess of Blackwood, again, on your own terms, whatever they may be." She was silent for a long time, her gaze searching his face. He saw the flicker of old hurts, the wariness, the caution. But he also saw something new, a softening, a hope. "My terms are simple, Alistair," she said finally, her voice clear and strong. "I will not be an asset. I will be a partner. I will not be invisible. I will be seen. And I will never, ever be told I am not invited." "Lecter." "Never," he vowed, his voice thick with emotion. "You are not just invited, Eleanor. You are the foundation. You are the home." She stepped forward, closing the small space between them, and laid her hand on his arm. "Then my answer is yes." A year later, the drawing room at Blackwood Manor was filled with afternoon sunlight. It was no longer a museum of priceless objects. It was a living space. Books lay open on tables, a stack of estate ledgers sat near a comfortable chair, and a vase of wildly colorful, slightly unkempt flowers from Eleanor's garden sat on the mantelpiece. Alistair stood by the French doors, the same doors where he had first assessed his wife like a piece of porcelain. He was watching her now. She was seated at a small desk he had had installed for her, a pen in her hand, a frown of concentration on her face as she reviewed plans for a new school on the Croft lands. She was no longer in faded lilac. She wore a gown of rich, deep blue, the color of a summer sky at dusk, and she was no longer a slip of a woman. Her form was fuller, her movements imbued with a new, gentle deliberation. She was 6 months pregnant with their first child, an heir he now thought of not as a dynastic necessity, but as a symbol of their improbable, hard-won joy. She looked up and caught him watching her. A slow, warm smile spread across her face. A smile meant only for him. "You are staring, Your Grace," she teased, her eyes sparkling with the wit he had come to cherish. "I am," he admitted, walking over to her. He knelt beside her chair, resting his hand on the gentle swell of her stomach. "I am seeing. I am noticing." He thought of the man he had been, the blind, arrogant duke who had mistaken silence for simplicity and stillness for emptiness. He thought of the cold words in his letter, the cruel dismissal in his study. He felt a pang of the old shame, but it was quickly replaced by a profound, overwhelming gratitude. Gratitude for her strength, for her quiet rebellion, for the courage it had taken for her to leave so that he could finally learn how to find her. She had not been invited, and so she had left. And in doing so, she had forced him to build a world where she belonged, a world where she was not just invited, but essential, a world where she was, finally and forever, home.